And welcome back to another special episode of the Epic Experiment Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce, and I'm joined on the line, as always, by Lux. Lux, what's up, my friend?
And not much, and things are going okay.
That's good to hear, good to hear. It feels a little weird. Like, audience, just so you know, we're recording a couple of days early because, again, I've got a little vacation time with my kids. So I'm going to be going on a short camping trip with my boys. My 7-year-old and my 4-year-old. So I'm not around to record on our usual night. So we've had to sort of scoot up the night that we record. So we're recording on a Saturday night, which feels a little bit weird, but it's always good to talk to Lux and find out what's shaking. So did I hear you say something to the effect that like your store got itself in hot water with the local constabulary?
Yeah. And as I said in a Lotus Castle chat, there's a bar across the street that wasn't allowed open, and the guy that owns the place, and he was not too happy about the LGS being allowed to open back up. So he basically went and told the city that we weren't following guidelines.
Oh, that's so petty. Why couldn't you just like, okay, somebody else was open, so let them be open and make their scratch, and if people want to go in, they go in. But, like, don't be petty about it. Jeez. That's why we can't have nice things, Lux. Someone roheads and ruins it for everybody else. That's the bottom line.
So, like, until further notice, we're still allowed to stay open, but we cannot and hold any gatherings, no events whatsoever.
So people can come in and buy cards and peruse the shelves, but they can't stick around to jam cards.
Unfortunately.
That's kind of stinky. That sucks. Even if you're following all the rules, some people spoil it for everybody. All right. I'm really disappointed for you there. That's really tough. We just got word what school is going to be starting to look like come the fall. And as a teacher, I'm a little concerned, to be honest. So it's not all rosy up here either. So. Oh man, I can't wait for this pandemic stuff to be done and over with. But I feel like it's going to be an awful long time before things go back to normal, huh?
And probably.
Yeah, it's tough. It sucks. As Lux said, you can find us both on the Lotus Council Discord, which is on thelotuscouncil.com. There's a link to their Discord. It is very active. Lots of interested people looking to talk all things Magic the Gathering and of course EDH and singleton formats in particular. So come and check them out. Also, while you're there, you can check out the podcast, because thelotuscouncil.com is the home of our podcast. So you can go check us out there. You find all the episodes, as far back as we go. So, but come check them out. They're great people. Lots of cool things going on. So come find out what's going on with thelotuscouncil.com. So our show is in 4 segments tonight. So I thought segment 1, because Double Masters literally just dropped for the public yesterday, Lux. I don't know about you, but in the Facebook groups and on Twitter, I've seen tons and tons of people posting their polls and posting things they're looking to sell. Have you been seeing the same sort of thing down near you?
Nope.
No? Oh, man. Like, there's been lots of sweet polls that I've seen and lots of amazing things that people are prepared to pull, and as a result, some people are trying to sell their stuff. And I thought it might be worth our while just sort of like reiterate to people that this set, even if you didn't buy it, you let other people open it, you can still reap the benefits of this set, and grab some really interesting reprints at some really reasonable prices. So long as you're looking to get the non-foils. Of course, like box toppers and foil box toppers and all this other stuff costs a small fortune. But if you're looking for the non-foil version of a lot of these cards, they're now being, released into the wild now at a suitable rate that the prices are reflecting the fact that this influx of supply. So so long as you're looking for things that are not the spicy toppers, and like, I get it. People who play EDH like to bling out their deck with the fanciest card going. However, if you're like us on this podcast, you may be more of a budget-oriented player, and you can't afford to play the fancy version of a card. And like that's a lot of what I look at. I can't afford the fanciest version of a card. And all this extra supply means that I don't have to afford the most expensive version. I can get something that costs a little bit less if I really want that card. Now, Lux, are you the same way? Like, do you like to find, do you like to foil out your decks, or do you like to find like a non-foil and just put it in the deck because the non-foil plays exactly the same as the foil?
And honestly, like when buying singles, and I try to go for the cheapest and the versions possible.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I appreciate that there are players out there that want the expensive card, but I am like you. I'm looking for the most inexpensive version of the card I can get. So, you know, this is sort of a great opportunity for people to jump in and grab cards at pretty reasonable rates. I picked a couple of examples. There's no real hard and fast rule why I picked these cards, but I know they're, generally speaking, pretty readily played in Commander, or if they're not, they probably could be. And, you know, what the prices of their previous printings might look like, and then what you can get them for now in Double Masters, according to MTG Stocks, which is sort of my go-to site for checking up prices and making sure that I know what certain cards are worth these days. So the first one on my list is Wreath the Redeemed, which if you were to buy it from its original printing in Shadowmoor, is about $17 a card. You know, it's a very powerful tokens playing commander. Fits very nicely in a lot of strategy. If you want to play it in the 99, can be the lead singer of its own deck if you want it to be. It's quite a good card, and at $17, it reflects the fact that it's playable, but it also reflects the fact that Shadowmoor is now old enough and was opened infrequently enough because it was printed at a time when sort of there was an economic recession, Magic was sort of on the wane. They had done something funny with the sets, like they had Lorwyn and Eventide and Shadowmoor. I don't know what, like the four, there was four sets in Lorwyn block. And so Wreath the Redeemed wasn't open nearly as much as it probably should have been, and so the price is fairly steep. Well, now it's $4 in Double Masters, and you can find your own Wreath the Redeemed if you're looking for one. Another one, great one, is Land Tax. No real need to explain what it does, but it's $35 to $37 depending on which previous printing you're looking at. You can get it today, like right now, for about $24 from Double Masters, which is a pretty significant savings. Like you're saving probably an extra 50% on the cards. So that's not a bad savings right there. Avacyn was $48 from Avacyn, sorry, Angel of Hope, which is the really good one, but she's very expensive. She's $48 from Avacyn Restored. You can get her right now for about $28. So just around half of what she was before. Sword of Light and Shadow, again, about $37 for his previous printing, and now you can probably find it today for around $25. And last but not least, sort of like the gold standard for cards in Commander, you have Cyclonic Rift, which previous printings are going for about $30, but you can grab it today for about $20, which is a pretty good savings. Like you're saving an extra 50% on what the original printings would have been worth. So there's lots of good to be had if you're looking to find cards. Now, none of these cards are cheap. Like, let's be real. I mean, maybe Wreath could be considered cheap as it's under $5. But these other cards are not cheap. But if you have a deck that's really desperately looking for a Rift or a Sword or an Avacyn or a Land Tax or, you know, going on down the list for so many of these cards, here's an opportunity for you to grab one at a pretty reasonable price. It's not insignificant amount of money, but it's much less than it would have been before. Are there anything from Double Master that you're excited to maybe be able to get your hands on, Lux?
And there's only one, and you know what it is.
Oh, I can think of a couple, but is it Crater Hoof?
Nope.
Ooh, Avacyn.
Bingo.
Yeah, Avacyn's pretty good. No, I think there's a lot. Like, I mean, there's things like Lightning Greaves. That's, you know, you can get it right now for about $4, which seems pretty strong. You can get, what else is there? It's sort of just a decent pickup, you know, as you go through stuff. Oh, Breya. Breya's like $8, which seems, well, not even, she's like $7. So you can get a lot of really nice, nice pickups for relatively little money. So, like, you can get a Grim Lavamancer for under $1. Joyra Weatherlight Captain is 99 cents. Like, Geth Lord of the Vault is 99 cents. Like, these are just really useful cards, and you can do all sorts of great things with them. So, if you're looking for the non-foils, don't have to look too far, because this sort of stuff is going to be helping keep the price of some of these things down for a little bit. I don't think it'll keep it down too long, particularly for some of these high-end pieces, but you can get, they definitely are helping with the supply. So that's our public service announcement here at the Epic Experiment Podcast. Like, if you're looking for pieces, go check Double Masters, see if there's anybody who's selling stuff. You never know what you're going to be able to dig up. Segment two tonight is, we thought it might be good to check in on, you know, give some tips for maybe newer players and who may be looking to build their first commander deck. So somebody was talking to me, and they said, you know what, Bruce, I really like your podcast, because you guys are essentially coming at this from a standpoint of, if you're a newer player and you're starting out playing commander, what do you do? What direction do you go? Because it's very easy to get intimidated by this format. Lux, would you agree? It's very intimidating to wade into Commander.
And honestly, I do agree, because let's just say that my first couple months of playing Commander, yeah.
Yeah, it's a real steep learning curve. Like, you maybe you've played only a pre-con, or maybe you've borrowed someone else's deck, and it all feels very surreal, very strange, because the card pool is so, so large. There are so many options, and you're just not sure what's good and what is good for the people you're playing with. And that's sort of one of the challenges. So, you know, you have this, how do I get into Commander if I want to build my own deck? Pre-cons are great, but you don't want to be playing a pre-con forever. You want to eventually build something that is your own. So where do you start? It's not easy. And there's lots of ways to do it, and lots of them are wrong. So we're here to help people, you know, steer them in the right direction, to help them find their way, to start putting together that very first commander deck. Or if you're not, maybe you have a deck, or you have a hard time making it all click and come together. So, you know, we thought we'd put together some advice here for our listeners. If anybody might be out there new and looking for some advice on how to get into building a deck, listen up. We've got some advice for you guys tonight. So, Lux, let's start at the beginning. What motivates you to build a new deck?
And honestly, what usually motivates me is when a new set comes out, and they have when they start to reveal like the legendary creatures, and I look at each one and I see which one is gonna something that I kind of want, you know, Ikoria, Netheroi, and they seemed pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think a lot of people start like you, where we look at the card a legendary creature that we like, and we say, I really want to see if I can use that card and play it. Like, I've done that many times, where I've seen a set, or I've opened a pack, or I've done whatever, and now I have this legendary creature in hand. This I want to try. I want to try this, whatever this is, and, you know, go nuts. So I'm like you. That's how I often start. And I think that's how lots of people sort of get excited around a new commander. That's what sort of, it becomes the impetus for your new deck. So, and, you know, audience, if you're out there listening and you go, well, I don't know. Look, if something doesn't sing to you, don't try and build it. Like, no one's going to compel you to build a deck. But if you find a nifty, cool commander that you kind of like, then by all means, grab it and see what you can do. Start piecing together what you think you've got. Now, we're going to borrow here from the Command Zone, which is, I'm sure if you're listening to our podcast, you probably also listen to those guys, because Josh Lee Kwai and Jimmy Wong are fantastic. But the Command Zone has basically started proposing a formula to help get you guys into the part where your deck is at least well constructed. It may not be, you know, optimized to the point where you're going to run the table down, but they've given you a starting point with some formulas sort of to give you the pieces you're going to need to have a deck that functions so that you can cast spells and be in the game. So their first piece is, of course, ramp. And ramp is probably, this format is so predicated on ramp that it is probably the number one piece that everyone needs to have in their deck. And if you can't ramp, you have a really hard time keeping pace and you know, finding at the end of the night that you win the game. So ramp is, you know, what they've identified as by far and away the most important feature, and they're suggesting that you have 10 ways of ramping in various ways. And I think there's sort of a hierarchy in terms of how you should be choosing to ramp. So I think the easiest and the most efficient way to ramp is by finding spells that allow you to get extra lands out of your deck. Would you agree, Lux, or would you put something else first?
Honestly, I think, and normally when I start building a deck, what I usually do is, you know, I start with the, you know, mana base first, you know, like lands and stuff.
Well, I very rarely start with the mana base, and I'll be honest with you, I start often with my ramp package, particularly if I'm in green. If I'm not in green, I need to explore other options to what's going on, because the mana base can come later, and particularly once you see what your mana requirements are. So let's say you're building Samet, like, and I'm going to be honest, a little bit of a spoiler here. Samet is the deck that Lux brewed up for this week's show. So Samet, the voice of dissent, she's red, green, and white for a Naya colored commander. But your deck may be invariably skewed towards two colors, and this third color is more of a splash, right? Or maybe you just go straight down the middle and there's a three-way split, right? But so I build my mana base after I've built the rest of my deck, so that I can take into account what I want to do with what I'm doing with the deck and how many cards of various colors I have. So I usually save the mana base for the very last thing. That doesn't mean I haven't pulled interesting lands out of a box and set them aside. But I don't typically start with my mana base. But that's interesting that you do. Why would you start with your mana base?
And the main reason why I start with that is so that when I basically start with the normal amount of lands for a commander deck, and then when I start putting in the creatures and the spells and the artifacts, and I take into account like how many cards there are, and I decide whether or not to either take out some lands to make room, or add some lands.
Fair enough. That's a fair way of looking at it. We'll come to the lands in a second, I think. So I think there's a good discussion to be had there when we talk about lands. So in our ramp package, Command Zone usually advises about 10 ramp target, 10 ways to ramp. And so, the choice to, in my mind, the best choice, if you can do it, is to go and get extra lands and put them into play. This is sort of taking advantage of the fact that most decks don't play a lot of mass land destruction to really punish you for digging extra lands out of your deck. So if you can dig extra lands and pull them into the battlefield, then you probably then you're going to have typically more mana than your opponents, meaning you can cast more spells and do more things like that. So, because lands are harder to destroy than many of the other things on this list, I tend to prioritize extra lands, particularly if I'm playing green. But even if I'm not, I do make a point of there's a number of artifacts that will help you go find land. It's one of the reasons why Solemn Simulacrum sees so much play, because it will go get you a land. So, extra lands are, my priority when I'm looking to ramp. After I have extra land spells, however many of those I choose to play, I'm looking for artifacts. Particularly mana rocks first. So things like Sol Rings and Arcane Signets and, Basalt Monoliths or other signets or whatever. I'm looking for mana rocks that produce mana. Maybe my deck wants more colored mana than not, but I'm looking for mana rocks. Again, artifacts are a little bit harder to destroy than creatures. As much as lots of people play a Vandal Blast or by Force or something like that and blow up a lot of artifacts, you can still get away with keeping your mana rock around long enough that it's really not a threat anymore, because everyone's caught up anyway, but it'll help you get ahead and get into the later stages of your game. So mana rocks, very useful. And there's a reason why the best ones cost plenty of money. There's other artifacts that produce single mana, treasure tokens or gold tokens or things of that nature. So, they're useful. And if you can produce them easily enough through something like a Smothering Tithe or something of that nature, then you can, these are useful artifacts for you to help with your ramp, but you have to be careful that they're not, you're not always going to be able to have these readily available if you need treasure tokens or gold tokens. Like, you've got to accumulate them and put them to use when you need them. The last thing I sort of put on my hierarchy of ramp, and we've talked about this before, is mana dorks. So, Elvish Mystics and Llanowar Elves and things of that nature. And I know, Lux, you like to play mana dorks perhaps more than I do. Is that true?
And pretty much.
It's interesting there, audience. You have two perspectives of two players who play quite a bit of Commander, and you have one player who values mana dorks quite highly with Lux. You have me who's not as keen to play them, and in fact, I very rarely play them in my decks. Because I'm very conscious of the fact that my mana dork dies to removal. And if I can shortcut that and not have my mana get targeted by that sort of removal, then I'm happier for it. But Lux, what's your premise for why you like to have more mana dorks than some of the other sources of ramp?
Mainly because whenever I'm playing in a deck that have like green in them, I'm wanting as much in a large mana base as possible. Thing, I basically want to ensure that I have enough mana to do whatever I want.
Oh, for sure, and that's what's all the whole idea of the ramp pack. Like, why would you choose a mana dork over like a spell like Sky Shroud Claim or Circuitous Route that's going to go put two lands into play for you, and get you ahead that way? Why would you pick a Llanowar Elves instead of a spell like that? Maybe that's about it. Maybe a Rampant Growth.
Well, and like, for me, when it comes to mana dorks, and I don't go for the ones that just give you like one. I go for ones that give you more than one.
What would be an example of something like that? So our audience has an idea like what that would look like. What is one of your preferred targets?
Well, and like, one that and I've had really good luck with in red green decks. And I know it's pretty expensive, but in Savage Vent Maw, just look at and how much he gives you, like three red and three green, whenever he attacks.
Yes, that guy makes a lot of mana. It takes a lot of mana to get him into play, and you've got to find a way to make an attack. But you are right; the Savage Vent Maw can do a lot in terms of helping you ramp. if you can get it out on the battlefield. So there are plenty of elves and creatures that produce two mana, absolutely. There's some. Let me think. We may have to come back to this thought, but there's lots of ones that make two mana, and or two or more mana, and so that they're really quite useful. Where is it a great example? I'm looking. Is this the set here? Might be in the next set. Oh yeah, no, there's a pretty good one here in Cat. That's this week's set that we're doing called Weaver of Currents. So for a one blue green, you get a 2/2 that says tap, add two colorless to your mana pool. So you get a 2/2, and when you can tap it, you can make two mana, which is surprisingly useful. So mana dorks have their place, and you have to be careful. But ask yourself, which sort of deck am I playing? Do I want it? Do I not? And take it from there. But at the end of the day, if you have 10 sources of ramp in your deck, you should be in a position where you can cast your spells, which is really the whole idea behind playing Commander. You want to cast your big spells to try and get the job done on the table. After you've got your ramp package together, the next important piece is draw. So you want to find a way to draw extra cards or draw additional cards in this game, because for every card that you draw, your opponents are drawing one each. So you're actually down cards every turn, because you're down two cards compared to the rest of the table, which is three opponents. So it's so important that you have some way to try and catch back up and recoup some of those cards and more or less get things back on. Pardon me, got distracted there for a second. Get yourself caught up for some of those cards that you'd like to draw but haven't yet. So card draw, super important. And again, there's a bit of a hierarchy there when it comes to draw. And I prioritize things that are repeatable sources of draw. Usually in the form of artifacts, because again, they're a little bit harder to destroy than creatures. But if I have to, a creature that will draw me cards is always appreciated. I definitely look for artifacts that draw me cards. One of my favorites, I've said it before on the podcast, is Tamio's Journal, is a great one. Yes, it's five mana, and the turn it comes into play, it doesn't do anything. But when you investigate on your upkeep each turn, that clue token is essentially represents a card for you. So you could sacrifice it, draw a card. So now you've drawn two this turn. So, it might be something small, but it's super powerful little effect. One that I think is, really quite powerful and is kind of overlooked right now is Chromatic Orrery, which is the new seven mana artifact from M21 that has an ability to draw you cards equal to the number of permanents with different mana costs, different colors on the battlefield for you, which can be a lot of cards, three, four, five cards potentially. So Chromatic Orrery is one of these artifacts that people sort of downplayed, because at seven mana it's very expensive, but it can turn into a card draw engine for you and could be really good. Do you have any artifacts that you like to use, Lux, that help people draw cards?
Well, there's always the lockets.
The lockets are good. They would be lower on my list of cards that would draw me cards, because you have to sacrifice them, right? But they are very good, and they're very budget friendly, so which makes them something that people probably should be looking at pretty consistently. Any others that you have?
And none that draw cards.
So I've got a couple that I like to play. So I've got Lifecrafter's Bestiary out of Aether Revolt. That lets you scry during your upkeep, but then if you cast a creature, you can spend green and draw a card. Very handy. You can do this repeatedly, and it's unlikely your opponents are going to target it because there are other more impactful artifacts that are out there, but it's a very valuable, useful artifact that can draw you 3, 4, 5, 6 cards over a number of turns, which goes a long way to helping you stay caught up. Another one that people might shy away from, and they, in no small measure because it's a symmetrical effect, is Otherworld Atlas, which is 4 mana for an artifact. You tap it to put a charge counter on Otherworld Atlas, and then tap it. Each player draws a card for each charge counter on Otherworld Atlas. And there's a lot of people who wouldn't want to play it because it's symmetrical and your opponents are drawing cards too. However, if at the bottom line, if you need to draw cards because you're out of answers, this sort of effect is interesting. But it also could really be a political tool for you in the game, where if somebody else at the table, like, you're out of gas, and but someone else may have an answer, you say, hey, look, what if I help us draw some cards? Can you point that nasty spell at that thing instead of at me? And you might be surprised how well you can bargain if you expect. So just because it's symmetrical doesn't make it bad. It just makes when you have to play it a little more circumspect. There are lots of creatures that are also help you draw cards, like Spectral Sailor would be another one. Beast Whisperer, which is it the one? That's the green one from Guilds of Ravnica. Whenever you play a creature, draw a card. There's lots of creatures that will help you draw cards if you're smart about it. So, these are repeatable. And because they're repeatable, they can perhaps draw you a little bit further ahead. Do you have any creatures that you happen to like better that draw cards?
I'm sure there are some, but none come to mind because there are some that I think draw cards. I'm not pretty sure though.
Fair enough. Which is a fair point. I mean, not everybody jump into mind with cards, like things that draw cards, but yeah, no, for sure. You can. Creatures that help you recoup cards or draw cards is good for you. Then there's things that are like spells that are single use. And I sort of like a card like Opportunity. 4 blue, instant speed, draw four cards. It's a very strong card. 4 cards is a lot, but it's a single use. You're only going to get one shot out of that card. And that's fine. And it scales. Like, I think you can play Think Twice, or you can play Divination. You can play all sorts of these cheaper ones to draw cards, or you can go the expensive route for Opportunity or, things of that nature. But if I'm going to have a single use draw spell, I tend to want to go for something, let's say, bigger, like a mass draw spell, like a Blue Sun Zenith or a Pull from Tomorrow, or if I could swing it, a Sphinx's Revelation, to try and get myself a big influx of cards to refill my grip and get things going. Because I do not love the cards like Divination. I do not love cards like Think Twice or things of that nature that are cheap, and yes, you can play them early, but like a spell like Pull from Tomorrow or Blue Sun Zenith with an X in the casting cost, they're flexible. You can cast them early. They're perhaps less impactful, but you can cast them early or you can cast them late to great effect. But Divination or Opportunity always is good. Opportunity and Divination do write what the card says. Lux, do you have any favorite draw spells that you like to cast?
Honestly, and I'm going to have to go through my decks because, like I said, I'm sure there are cards that have the draw effect on them, but that's not really my thing, though. Like drawing cards, that's not really the kind of thing I go for.
Well, I was going to say, looking at, for instance, the Samet deck as an example, you're looking to play creatures, and there isn't a lot of draw in your list. But you have other ways to create card advantage through other means. And we'll talk about that in a second. Things that simulate card draw would be what I would probably put next. And so a great example right here in Lux's list, it would be Helm of the Host as a way to create simulated card draw. All right. So it's not really card draw or generating card advantage. Helm of the Host is helping to make a token each turn of another creature that you happen to have. And hopefully it is something that is going to be big and scary and help you win. So as much as Helm of the Host isn't actually card draw, it is giving you card advantage because now you have tokens to with which you can use and do things that are going to be perhaps more interesting than not. So that's one example. There's lots of the other ones. Another good one I like to talk about is Soul of Innistrad being a way to help you get things out of your graveyard. So sometimes you make tokens and with Helm of the Host or other token makers, sometimes you can use card advantage by getting cards back out of your graveyard. And as much as you haven't drawn cards off the top of the deck, now you've gone and pulled useful pieces back out of your graveyard to be reused. And that is generating for you card advantage that you can then use to sort of fill that gap of how do you maintain the resources that you need to beat your opponent. Are there any other simulated card draw or card advantage engines that you could think of, Lux, off the top of your head?
Oh, and simulated card draw and stuff that creates and have tokens. Master's Call, there was that other one that you recommended.
Oh, so you can play Raise the Alarm, for instance, as a token maker. So you're making two bodies for one card. Which is kind of like generating a little bit of card advantage. However, in the case of both Master's Call, which it's two and a white to make two servo tokens, Raise the Alarm, one and a white, instant speed, make two soldier tokens. Neither of these creatures, these little creatures, are particularly inspiring in and of their own right. However, if you have ways to make them impressive, so I noticed your list today, and I feel like I'm stealing some thunder from you. You have Divine Visitation in your list. So if you have a Divine Visitation in your list, now your two 1/1 tokens that you're making are 4/4 Flying Angels, and that is a card. A 4/4 Flying White Angel is absolutely a card, even if it's a token. It makes people really have to sit up and take notice, because or else they're going to find themselves taking a heap of damage. So, cards that make multiple tokens, multiple bodies, is a way of generating a simulated card advantage. Another one that I like is Sunbird's Invocation, which is five and a red for an enchantment. And these sort of enchantments are super useful. Sunbird's Invocation reads, whatever you cast from your hand, reveal the top X cards of your library, where X is that spell's converted mana cost. You may cast a card revealed this way with converted mana cost X or less without paying its mana cost. Put the rest of the on the bottom of your library in a order. So, okay, you cast a spell, and let's say you cast an IKEA of the old ways, because it happens to be sitting here in a pile beside me. It's a 5-mana creature. You go and look at 5 cards. You can go cast something for 5 mana or less. And while that's not necessarily you don't necessarily know what you're going to get, but you're probably going to get 2 cards for the price of 1, which is a pretty good way of doing it. So simulated card advantage through something like that is another avenue to go in and fill that gap. So there's lots of ways. Go ahead, Lux.
And I was going to say that while we're on the topic, and there's one card that's in my list that I really need to give the spotlight to, because this one's been a big help, especially when paired with Divine Visitation.
Yeah.
And honestly, this is basically, ever since I acquired my first copy of it, this has been a favorite of mine, Assemble the Legion.
Yeah, that's another great way of generating card advantage. If your opponents don't answer it and remove it from the table, it can get out of control, particularly with your illustrious divine visitation. So instead of 1/1s with haste, you're getting 4/4 angels, which is very quickly going to dismantle the game. The last sort of draw that I put on here that's perhaps less interesting is cantrips. So cantrips is a card that, here's an effect, and then you draw a card to replace the one you just spent. Probably the best example of this card is Opt. So you cast Opt, one blue for instance, scry one, then draw a card. So you're not up cards, but you're also not down cards. And I would be very careful to play cantrips in your commander deck. Not that they're bad, but if you're spending a card slot of your 100 cards for cantrips, there has to be a reason for doing that, because they tend not to be the sort of cards that get you ahead. They do help you dig if you were looking to do that, but they're not, very rarely are they helping you get ahead on things. Same thing with cycling. Cycling can be very powerful in the sense where if you have a card with cycling that is not useful to you, you cycle it away to draw another card that hopefully is going to help you. It helps you dig and card filtering and card selection, but it doesn't really draw you more cards to have more resources for your game. So, I'm always cautious of cantrips or in my decks. I tend to shy away from them for the most part. Anything about cantrips you want to add there, my friend?
And honestly, and need to go through my list because, and you told me that, and I have some in this list, don't I?
Do you have some cantrips in your list? You probably do, but I'm not. I have to go look carefully and very careful. Oh yeah, you have Haze of Pollen, which is like Haze of Pollen is an interesting card. It's got if you need to fog it down, you can fog. But you can also cycle it away for three. So when the fog is not useful because there's no creatures on board, then you can cycle it away to go find something that you really want to use. So again, you've got some. You do have some in this list. So you do have some sources of card draw, not a lot, but some. So, that's sort of the hierarchy that I've sort of assembled in my thought process around drawing cards and trying to generate card advantage. And again, the Command Zone recommends you play probably 10 sources, some 10 or more if you can do it, because the more cards you have in hand, the better it is. But, let's try and keep it as straightforward as we can. 10 is, a pretty easy target for people to hit. Then we have your removal and your, whatever you have to disrupt your opponent. And so in this category, I put board wipes of a couple of different varieties here. So not just destroying creatures, but oftentimes you need to find ways to destroy artifacts or enchantments too. So there's nothing wrong with playing a Vandal Blast in your deck or a Biforce, because they can allow you to take out a lot of artifacts all at once. They count as board wipes because so many times people, build up a strong board state because they've got 3, 4, 5 artifacts that they're leaning on for various effects. Sometimes it's mana, sometimes it's tokens, sometimes it's other effects that they're playing on. Maybe they're taxation effects or whatever. So having a way to take those out of the equation are important. Don't be shy to play mass enchantment removal. All right. So I know people like to, how many enchantments do I need to kill? Well, I can think of many in Commander that are really, really, really problematic. Lux, have you ever played a game where you have two opponents who either have a Dictate of Erebos or a Grave Pact on the battlefield?
And no, I have not.
Well, that is just a self-reinforcing loop to help everybody sack everything at the table. Because once one creature dies, Grave Pact sees a creature dies, everyone has to sack. Dictate of Erebos then sees something's died, everybody has to sack. because something's stacked. Oh, Grave Pact triggers again. Then Dictated Variables triggers and triggers and triggers and triggers till nobody's got anything left on the board. So you need to have ways to take out multiple enchantments if and you'd be surprised the number of times you have to do it. So don't shy away from it. If you can't and you only have to play targeted removal for those, that's fine. But if you've got space in your deck to put in a mass removal spell for some enchantments, you're probably going to be thankful. And then a couple to remove creatures. I usually put 3 to 4 in my deck of various sorts. Maybe you could put more, but I would be hesitant to rely on my opponents to have the answers for troublesome enchantments. So I like to have some of that built into my deck as well. How many board wipes do you normally play, Lux?
And I normally play a few, but considering the reaction to them, and I told you this before, when people got tired of it, so they started gunning for me first, and that was always eliminated.
Well, I think there's a difference between playing like a removal, like a sweeper, that it serves a purpose. If you're just blowing up stuff willy-nilly because you drew it, well, that's a waste of your stuff. But if there's somebody who's obviously in an advantaged position because they've assembled the board state, I'll use the example I was playing the other night, and my opponent had an archetype of endurance on the battlefield, meaning all his creatures had hexproof, which negated two of the cards in my hand that were targeted removals that would have been much preferable to be used here to surgically remove the most troublesome pieces instead of everything. However, I couldn't remove them because the archetype kept them on the battlefield, and so a supreme verdict ended up being the answer I drew to deal with the problem. And so, there's nothing wrong with having some board wipes, and if your opponents are getting mad and salty at you over using your board wipes judiciously, then your friends need to give their head a shake. But if you're just playing jockle hops just to blow everything up and watch the world burn and piss everybody off, well, okay, like I can understand why they're frustrated. I can understand that.
And honestly, I'm going to tell you the truth. I normally use jockle hops as kind of like a broken arrow strategy.
Just to torch everybody.
Yeah, no, Nate. If I'm going to lose, I'm taking everyone with me.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Some people, probably aren't too receptive to that because it definitely looks like you're in the process of just dragging the game out. But I do appreciate that some people are, out there looking to make people's life difficult. So, do also include single target removal in your stuff. I know a lot of people don't like to put it, but you probably should run more than you think. I have a personal propensity to run unconditional removal. Hero's Downfall is probably my default one, but Silence the Believers and other things of that nature that just remove problematic creatures are good. But other things, so Manglehorn and Reclamation Sage, do a really good job of blowing up, artifacts and enchantments. One that I found that is surprisingly funny that is in a deck I have here, actually sitting right here, is it is Gorilla Shaman. I'm pretty sure is the name of the card. It's an old one from Alliances that I found in an old box. Gorilla Shaman, and so one red for a 1/1 summon gorilla. XX1, destroy target non-creature artifact with casting cost equal to X. And that is just an activated ability on a creature. Doesn't tap it, doesn't do anything. So, that sort of ability to get rid of artifacts, could come in surprisingly handy. Are there any? Do you have any favorite target removal spells that you like to?
Honestly, when it comes to targeted removal, I think one of the biggest ones that I like, it's because you can choose more than just in the like one card, and they but and they, it's they, this is still target removal and like casualties of war.
Oh yeah, that one is very, very powerful. And I like that. That is a bit of a hidden gem. People forgot about it with all the spice in the out there, but in War of the Spark. But yeah, that's a great one. Love that one. And it answers a wide range of threats, which is sort of exactly what we're looking for. We're looking to have something that will deal with a bunch of different things. War casualties of war is a great one. The last sort of thing I put in here in terms of like removal or disruption is ways to protect your stuff. There's lots of your opponents who will go and they'll think that the board wipe they have is the answer they need, but nothing sets them back further than when you Rootborn Defense or you Heroic Intervention or something to protect your creatures so they don't get wiped and everyone else has disappeared. And that's, you know, a really, really potent way to negate the effect of somebody else's board wipe and really disrupt the game. So I always try and put a couple of sources of protection, particularly if I'm running a deck that's got an awful lot of creatures. But Rootborn Defenses, Heroic Intervention, make a stand, these sorts of things that protect your things are, you know, probably, you know, underappreciated and could be, really, really, really useful cards. Are there any other things that you include for in protection, or do you just get blown out by your board wipes? Technical difficulties for Lux. Well, it wouldn't be a show without a technical snafu. There you go, we got you back.
Like I was saying, whenever I play a board wipe that's going to target me, I try to make sure, because with her being the 8 mana, I'm most likely not going to have Avacyn on the field.
Yeah,
I make sure that I have something like Heroic Intervention, as you said.
Yep. Does your list include Archangel Avacyn? No, it doesn't. It probably should, because you can flash her in and protect your stuff too.
Well, and I'm gonna be honest with you, and this list right here is kind of outdated.
That's fair enough. I'm sort of assuming as much, but anyway. Yeah, no. So yeah, you got to find some ways to protect your stuff and stop the board wipes from taking you out. Then we come to our lands, and typically, if you're building a deck, 36 to 40 land is the ballpark where you want to be. More if you're building a big Lands Matter deck. So if you're building Gitrog, or maybe you're building Lord Windgrace, you want more. If you are looking to build something more typical, then you could probably get away with 36, 37, 38 land. I often run between 36 and 38. I have decks that go as high as 40. I don't think I have any that go as high as 40, like 42 or 44. Like, what do you find you usually run, Lux? How many lands do you run?
I usually run in between like 30, 40 lands.
Between 30 and 40?
Yep.
Yeah, so I know people who try and cheat and shave lands, and one of the sort of big problems that people have is that they start and they build their deck, and then they open up new stuff or get a new card, and they want to play it too, but aren't sure what to cut, so they take out a basic land, and they put in their new spell, and if you do that three or four times, then pretty soon their land count ends up being too low, and your deck doesn't work optimally. So. Try and resist that temptation, and if you're going to upgrade something, take something else out first. And the only other advice that I have, particularly for decks that are playing that are two colors, even three colors as well, the more untapped lands you have, the better, because you can then play. You can use them the turn they come into play. If you have scads and scads of lands that come into play tapped, you're going to perpetually be templing yourself out by a turn with all your lands. So more untapped lands, the better. So more basics, everybody. The answer is more basics. Huh. So we've already gone through. So we've gone through that formula. Like the number of lands. We've got your removal package. We've got your ramp package. We've got your card draw package. Now what? And even better, some of these things can play double duty. But if you can't, it's fine. But now that you with your remaining card slots, you probably got maybe 30 card slots left in your deck. What are you doing with the rest of your deck? And so, you want to make sure your deck is a deck and not just a pile of cards. So the first thing I always do is I read my commander very, very carefully. And I ask myself this question. What does this card make me want to do? Some of them are really obvious. Like if you play Atraxa is just like, you want to do everything, all the things, all the time. You want to play Planeswalkers, play Planeswalkers. You want to play Poison and Infect, play Poison and Infect. You want to play +1/+1 counters, whatever. Like Atraxa lets you do lots of things, and so you have lots of options. Others aren't as obvious. Lavinia of the Tenth, not as clear cut. What does this card make you want to do? Stop and really make you want to think. What sort of deck wants to play Lavinia? Or what sort of deck wants to play Afara? Both blue-white commanders, incidentally. And I happen to have both of them built. But yeah, like some of them are obvious, some are not. So you really have to stop and ask yourself the question. So let's use the example tonight. We've been talking about it all along. Samet, Voice of Dissent. Let's read her. 3 red, green, flash. Double strike, vigilance, haste. Other creatures you control have haste. It's a 3/4, and for white and a tap, untap another target creature. What does Samet make you want to do, Lux, when you look at Samet?
Well, as you can tell, what I'm wanting is, I'm wanting to ensure that when my creatures, either permanent or token, come out into the battlefield, I want to make sure that they can come out swinging.
So you're leaning on the haste component of Samet, correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
So I'm just imagining the way you're going to play this. You're not just going to run Samet out there any old time. You're going to save Samet for the end step before you want to do something big, flash her out, do your thing, whatever it is, something big. Maybe you want to cast Secure the Waste. Maybe you want to cast Entreat the Angels. Maybe you want to do something like that. Make a bunch of tokens, Divine Visitation, makes them all into 4/4s. And now you have a whole bunch of 4/4s with haste that are going to come after your opponent. This is, if this is how you read Samet, then you're going to take your deck in that logical conclusion to try and maximize that ability. Somebody else is going to read Samet and is going to lean on the fact that she's double striking. And now you've got the potential for knocking your opponent out with commander damage if you could Voltron this thing up and slip it by. Because, yeah, she's a 3/4, but if you put a sword on her and then put, like, just you Voltron her up, very quickly she can hit 10 or 12, and now she's single shot knocking people out with commander damage, which is another totally viable avenue to play Samet. If you want to play Samet as a Voltron commander, that's cool too. But you have whichever direction you want to take it, you need to be clear about what you want to do with your deck. All right. So once you know what to do, how are you going to make that be the thing you're going to do? And then how much synergy and how much support are you really going to include? So you're going to look at things like strong synergy pieces. So I'm looking at Lux's list, and like I can see he's clearly leaning into this token angle. He wants to play token. So he's got Assembled Legion, Divine Visitation, Growing Ranks, Parallel Lives, but what else goes on? Well, Master's Call, or, you know, raise the alarm. What else makes tokens and looking around? Anyway, you're looking at making tokens with that, which plays into this hasty creature angle. You're going to look for good utility pieces. So things like Call of the Wild, I think, is the name of the enchantment. It's from Ravnica Allegiance. One red, blue, green. Creatures you control can't be countered. And then on top of that, you get the ability to have them have Riot. So that's a surprisingly useful effect that synergizes well and provides good utility to protect you from having your things get countered. Like, you would much like to have, very much like to have this sort of enchantment on the battlefield long before you go to play your Samet, if that's, you know, what you're going to try and slam to get to slam the door shut. But I'm still looking for the card. Where is it? I can't find it. Anyway, so you want good utility pieces, strong synergy pieces. Can any of them double up? Can your card do something like protect your creature and provide haste? Or can it provide, you know, other things that you're looking for, like protection? So asceticism provides some protection by giving your creatures hexproof, makes them harder to destroy. Pretty handy. Are there any engines that you want to sort of assemble that are going to do something to make your deck kind of fun and more powerful that you can run? So those are some areas where I start. And I just, we'll go back to Lux's deck. And, you know, we're looking for strong synergy pieces. Well, there's, you know, Aurelia's Fury, which provides, you know, tapping your opponent down so you can attack, you know, more easily. Or, you know, Boros Charm, so you can give all your creatures double indestructibility as you need it. There's a number of these pieces that go into this sort of deck. You know, Shauna Sisse's Legacy plays into the angle of tokens. The Guildmage, Tristani, like, there's lots of token makers here. If that's how Lux has chosen to exploit this synergy that of providing your creatures with haste, so that big things can come out fast and, you know, start laying waste to your opponents. Is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of, like, synergy pieces or utility pieces?
Hold on, I was muted. Crap.
Oh, well, you're back now. Go ahead.
And honestly, I can't really think of anything else that we haven't gone over yet that I'm pretty sure by now people aren't already aware of.
Maybe. But there's, we got to remember, people are building their first deck, so they need to really have these things in mind. Like, so... that's sort of where I'm coming from. Like, how do you help people sort of frame the thought process about building your deck? And, like, building a deck is not something you do in 20 minutes. It takes sometimes, you know, several hours, sometimes several days to sort of sit there and weigh all these options. So it's no small feat to put together to get a deck. Regardless of your commander, you should be aware of, are there any combos that you need? And as much as, you know, personally, I don't subscribe to very many infinite combos. In fact, I can think of only two decks that I own that have got an infinite combo, in, which roughly represents about 10% of my decks. I'm very aware that people do put combos in decks. And if you're playing a combo-tastic commander, you probably need to at least weigh the options of, like, should I play this combo or not? And if the answer is, well, why not? This doesn't cost too much. Well, by all means, go ahead and do it. So long as you're up front with your play group. There's going to be other people that, you know, like me, that, you know, don't want to play the combo. And, but even so, if they see that combo-tastic commander, they're going to be looking to dismantle you, because they know that if your commander is left to go unchecked, you might have this instant win count con in your deck. I use one that I played against, you know, at a game. I've perhaps recounted the story before. I was playing a three-person game, and one of the guys was sitting on Azuri Claw of Progress, which is the blue-green experience counter Azuri. And he played the Sage of Hours, which is a creature that can grant opponents grant your opponent an infinite turn, or sorry, an extra turn if they remove X number of counters from it. Well, the experience counters on the Claw Proc Azuri trigger, go on Sage of Hours. Sage of Hours can take off the requisite number, take an extra turn, and they can take infinite extra turns, winning the game, because eventually they're going to do something so large that I can't fight back. So, that's, you need to be aware of that combo if you're running the deck, even if you're not running the combo, because people are going to think you are. Would you agree, Lux? Have you seen decks that like could have a combo finish but don't?
And I've seen a couple.
Okay, what example of one good one?
Well, and like there was this one in a new Thassa deck that I was going up against. They had the perfect combo to just completely, and they could have just, and they built up, and they. I know this is really mono boost thing, but this is Thassa we're talking about, and he was able to ramp the creatures up big time. But let's just say that he just wasn't able to execute it.
Right.
He didn't get the necessary cards to pull off the combo.
Right, but you had to have it in the back of your brain all the time that he could have comboed up if he drew it, right? So you got to be aware. So that's something that he might. And if you're running that, if you're a commander, you need to know that, if there is a combo, you can tell people, no, I don't have it. They're not going to believe you till you show it to them, like, I don't have it. It's not something in the deck. I didn't build it that way. You should also be looking at some redundancy. So if your main piece gets sniped, whether it gets exiled or it gets discarded or whatever, how can you get it back? Is there what other course of action are you going to be able to take? Because if your deck can't do the thing, how can you win? And so. Sometimes there's a duplicate effect that you can access, maybe, not as efficient, but you can use a duplicate effect to great effect to get, the ball rolling again. Or maybe you have a way that you can get it right back. So if you're in, particularly black and green, but sometimes in blue, sometimes in red, you have ways to get certain pieces back out of your yard. And make use of them again. So if you're running a game plan that is fragile and can be removed fairly readily, and let's be honest, anything that's stapled to a creature can be removed, but anything stapled to a creature can also be brought back. So, how are you going to do that is pretty key. And there's lots of inexpensive ways. I mean, lots of people play, I'm going to play Eternal Witness. But if you can't play Eternal Witness because it's out of your price range or you don't have one, you can play a Den Protector. You can play, one of the many, many ways to get a creature back. But, you need to have a plan for what you're going to get back if your key piece gets removed. Now, Lux, do you often go into, what is your approach to redundancy? Are you looking into build duplicates or are you looking to get things back?
And I'm mainly going for duplicates.
So you're looking to double up on the effect. If your thing goes to the bin, it goes to the bin, you're done, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Fair enough. And there's decks I have that do that too. And the possibility to get things back just doesn't exist. So you need to find other ways to get your game plan going. I always include a couple of A-plus level threats. Hard to answer Eldrazi or... scary things that, make a mess of the board. A couple of, just those A-plus level threats, just to keep your opponents honest, because, they might be the sort of card that is a deal breaker. Good example for me is oftentimes play Ulamog and Ceaseless Hunger. I have it in probably more decks than not. And, that's sort of my go-to trump card to squash my opponents where they just have a hard time answering. It is just so big and so powerful, and the effect is so strong that, you know, that's sort of, you know, where I go to. Do you have any you know, sort of favorite A pluses that you go to?
Well, and I'm not sure if you would count them as A pluses, but there's one card in here that I count as an A plus, and I really have the War Leader.
Well, she's very, very good because it's what extra combat phase. Like, she's very, very good, very difficult to deal with. You know, a little on the expensive side, but very, very good. So yeah, that would be the sort of thing I would keep in mind. You know, because extra combat phases often make a mess of the board. Something to keep in mind. Another example would be a Craterhoof Behemoth if you have one in a token deck. If you can afford it, like, why not? If you can't afford Craterhoof. So, like the End Race Forerunners or Decimator of Provinces can play a good, you know, poor man's imitation of it. But stuff like that, you know, just things that, you know, are going to tip the board in your favor. Now, you may have a few additional card slots. And now you have to ask, what other effects might you be missing that you would really like to have? You're not going to get a lot, folks. And sometimes this is where your spicy cards are. Sometimes it's just you play like boring staples because you're looking for a particular effect. But, you know, they can, if you've built your deck smartly, that there should be a couple of slots there for something interesting that you might want to try that, you know, you wouldn't normally think of. And then last but not least, are there any sort of fun or cute or obscure or thematic cards that go with your deck? So, you know, if you're playing a kitty cat or dog deck, like, are there any, like, you know, do you want to play like a Basilisk Collar because it's got collar on it and dogs wear collars, or I don't know, something funny like that, right? Where people, you know, is there a card that you want to play that sort of fits a theme or something fun that you want to do to sort of let your personality shine through in the deck. And it might be something that's totally ridiculous and kind of silly, and that's okay. Commanders should be fun. Like, I know we talk very seriously about it here, but you should have some fun with your deck construction. So if you do something silly, that's okay. Things that shine through for your show off your personality are always appreciated. So, but yeah. Do you have any pet cards that sort of fit in this category of something fun or obscure or cute that you like to slide in there, Lux?
Well, one I wish that, and I've talked about before on the show, of course, would be Vulpine Goliath.
Vulpine Goliath, indeed. I was just going to say, I'm pretty sure I knew that. So, but yeah, no. So I'm looking at a deck here I've got assembled, and there's a card that I've been looking at for years that I would love to get a chance to play is Boros Battle Shaper. And this is sort of one of these fun cards that, you know, my deck wants to go to combat lock, and Boros Battle Shaper, you know, helps me to dictate how and what is blocking, which is surprisingly fun. So I think it's kind of silly and kind of goofy, but I'm going to try it out and see how it goes. So that's sort of my sort of take on, you know, sort of a fun or silly card in this sort of deck because it's so obscure and sees very little play. All right. So with this advice, like audience, this is not going to shoot the lights out. Like, let's not kid ourselves. You're not going to go be running down competitive EDH tables. But what this does, it gives you a solidly constructed deck that will make your opponents work to, and you're going to have a chance to cast spells and be part of the game. Will you win? Well, maybe, maybe not. And that's not really the point. The real point is, are you going to be embarrassed? No, you're not going to be embarrassed. You very clearly have a plan. You're enacting it. You're trying to cast your things. And you may not get there. And that's okay. But at least you have a puncher's chance. And that's really all we can ask for in a game with three opponents. You're asking for a puncher's chance to maybe take out one, two, three players and see if you can. So, you know, I look at, you know, when I play Commander, I'm like, how am I going to make my opponents work for taking me out. If they can't do it, then I'll be darn sure I take them out. But I got to make them work. I got to make them work for it. Nothing's going to come easy. I'm not just going to roll over and let them stomp me. This sort of formula gives my decks a pretty good ability to be in the game, even in the late stages. Any last words from you, Lux, on deck construction?
No, not really.
No? All right. Fair enough. We're going to quickly review Amon Kett before we get to Lux's deck, although I feel like we've sort of gone over lots of it already, but it's still worth talking about. So Amon Kett came out in the spring of 2017. It was Egyptian-themed, which was kind of cool. Now, the plane of Amon Kett is a plane that Bolas has already visited and conquered. And so it still bears, you know, the scars of that visitation from our dear friend, Mr. Nicol Bolas. The mechanics of the set were the recycling, which is pretty cool because we just saw that in Ikoria. There's Embalm, which is a mechanic that allows you to exile a creature from your graveyard and it comes back as a token. Then there's Exert, which allows you to attack. And when it exerts, it stays tapped the next turn, but has this extra effect. And last but not least, we have Aftermath, which was a card that had split card, but different than the ones from we've seen with Dragon's Maze and stuff like that. Also, -1/-1 counters was a theme in this set, so lots of interesting things to go on, because we haven't seen -1/-1 counters in a long time. Some key cards in the set. So the Bicycle Lands, which are lands that are typed with both land types, so Island Swamp, Mountain Forest, that thing. And they can cycle, which is surprisingly good. We have Anointed Procession, which is sort of like one of the big ones from this set, particularly for token builds. Pull from Tomorrow, Approach of the Second Sun, which was very big in Standard at the time. Nissa, Steward of Elements, Liliana, Death's Majesty, as being a pair of planeswalkers that were very strong. And Gideon of the Trials, which should be lumped in there. Gideon, because there's a clause on it that they use it, and then as long as you own a Gideon, they can't lose. Lord of the Accursed was an example of zombie tribal coming through. You had Ronus is a big old boy of in green just to bash face. Enigma Drake ended up being part of like a blue-red Spells Matters deck. It later became like 8 Drake with Crackling Drake from Guild of Ravnica. As for Toll, which has untold potential yet. Glorybringer, which is a big old Daggeron. And then we have Soulscar Mage, which is a great prowess creature. We had a bunch of commanders in this set. I think it was 9 commanders in this set. So you had Vizier of Poisons, which is all about -1/-1 counters and tokens. It was Samet with 795 decks, and it's like Naya Value Town. Neheb the Worthy with 323 decks is all about Minotaurs for the most part. Temet, Vizier of Noctamoon, which is a blue-white tokens deck with Embalm. Ronath the Indomitable, which is 224 with Mono Green Biggins. Keftet the Mindful with 205 is a mono blue control deck. Hazoret the Fervent with 128 decks. Oketra the True with 89 decks, and it's like a mono white token build. And Bantu the Glorified is a mono black sacrifice. So, which brings us to our Samet, the Voice of Descent deck. So, Lux, I'll let you talk us through what's going on here with Samet. I'll include the link in the show notes, and it's going to go up on our Moxfield account so people can find it. But we'll let Lux talk about it as he's the guy who did it.
And I'm not sure if I said, told you this story before, but when Amon Kett in the first release, like on launch day, I went to my LGS and got me a booster box of it. And get this, like the first pack I pulled, which was in the one on the middle on top, like I opened that one up, and what do I pull? I pull Samet. So, and I was looking at it and like reading it, And I was like, you know, these are the kinds of colors I've been wanting to build a deck around. And when the giving all your creatures in haste when they enter the battlefield, that was just an added bonus. And I was like, you know, I could really go for a theme here. And so I started looking for ways of getting the support from that, you know, and the creatures that when they have abilities that when they attack and they give you stuff and like extra mana or they give you life and things like that. And I was like, these are kinds of things that people are not going to want on the battlefield. And I want to ensure that I can use them before they eventually get removed from the battlefield. So what better way than having a commander that just automatically gives them haste when they enter the battlefield?
Makes sense to me.
And then, another thing I was thinking of is that, tokens can go a long way when it comes to giving haste. Because I know, one-ones aren't really all that threatening. That's why, for a while, up until guilds came out, the whole Assembled Legion thing just wasn't really working because they just get knocked out big time.
Right. Yeah.
And then when Guild Ravnica came out, and I was looking at the spoilers, and I saw Divine Visitation, and I was thinking I could really pair that with Assemble the Legion when they could honestly help them not just get knocked out of the water the second they hit the field.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's solid. That's good tech. I like it.
And of course, not to mention another thing about the tokens that I was going for, this is why I added a card, Cryptolith Rite, is because it lets you tap creatures for mana, and that includes token creatures. So what better way than just having a mass token generator, a machine just spitting out tokens to the left and right, and you can just tap those for mana, and you can basically just cast anything you want.
Sounds fun. I like that. I found that music to my ears, isn't it?
But of course, that's not the only thing that you see in this deck. There's some really fun stuff in here, too.
Well, I'm looking at it, and some things that really jump out, things that are like your A-plus bombs that people make me sit up and take notice, are things like Aurelia, for sure, Avacyn, Gisela, Blade of Gold Knight. You're running both Gisela the Broken Blade and Bruna the Fading Light, which means you have access to Brizella, which is terrifying in its own right. But you also have things like value creatures like Ramunap Excavator, which is just a very powerful effect. I mean, that's Crucible of Worlds on a creature. And that's really, really powerful, particularly if you have any way of getting value out of your lands in your graveyard. Shastani, Slesnia's Voice, and the Populate tokens. There's just lots of really good things to be found in this deck that are, make me sit up and take notice. I do notice your list has got a lot of creatures, 32 creatures, which makes a card like Vizier the Menagerie far more powerful than it would be in other decks where they don't have nearly as many creatures. So, Vizier of the Menagerie is something really, really quite noticeable here. Any last words there, Lux, or do you want to? I think you said all we need to say about Senate.
Well, and the one thing I was going to add is, as you can see in the list, one really good combo that I added in here to basically go in hand with an Samus and a haste ability. The ever so infamous and Aurelia Helm combo.
The Aurelia and Helm, yeah, that would be, yeah, so it's infinite combat stages and more creatures. More Aurelias. True? Is that how that one works? Where'd you go again?
And that's and how it works. And of course, like with in a Tristani and a like Selesnya's voice on the field, like you're basically just gaining life, and every time you create a new Aurelia token.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's really powerful. So you eventually you end up with infinite Aurelia tokens. Hopefully, you have stamina on the battlefield, so they all have haste. Aurelia's got haste anyways, and a very large quantity of life thanks to Tristani. So that would be ideal, to say the least. Wow, that's fun. I like that deck. I'll have to compare notes with you because I have a Samet deck. I actually just built it, you know, last week, and we'll have to compare notes a little, Lux. See how yep. I did. But I think we're starting to run late, so I think we'll wrap it up. Does that sound okay to you, Lux?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. So yeah, I was going to draw this week's show to a close. If you want to leave us some feedback, you can reach out to us on social media. Our email address is theepicexperimentpodcast. By all means, let us know how you build your decks. What process do you follow? Do you go through some of the same steps we do? Do you have other things that you do? Let us know. The more insight we have, the better we can help new players frame their thought process around how decks get built. If you want to hit us up on Twitter, by all means, please hit us up at theepicexpcast. Little link will be in the show notes. You can follow us there. If you want to find all of our decks, you can find us on Moxfield, moxfield.com at the Epic Experiment Podcast, all one word. Please go check out the decks. There's now lots and lots of decks there for people to check. We've been putting, our decks for the show, but on top of it, decks that we've been playing with on Arena, whether for Brawl or for Standard, and people might be interested in those too. So if you're looking for a lot of decks, come check them out. You'll be appreciative of the look. Next week, we're going to be moving on to Hour of Devastation, which is a fun set in its own right. We got to finally see Nicol Bolas show up after having, seen him be a bad guy in the shadows for ages and ages and ages. Now he comes to the fore, and the set is pretty spicy because there's a new Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, the first time in quite a while. So, until then, this is the Epic Experiment Podcast, signing off, wishing you all the best wherever you next get to play Magic. Thanks very much, everybody. Take care. Have yourself a great week. See you again next time.